The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of Spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click Publicize Your Book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Greetings, I'm Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. And I'm so excited to bring you today's guest. The book is Climate Action Planning, A Guide to Creating Low Carbon, Resilient Communities by Michael Boswell, Adrian Greve, and Tammy Seal, published by Island Press in 2019. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tricia. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your educational background?
Sure. I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Central Florida in political science. And at that time, while I was doing that degree, I discovered the profession of city planning and decided that's what I wanted to do as a career. So I went to graduate school at the Florida State University in urban and regional planning and did my master's there. I went out and worked for a few years in local government planning, doing pretty traditional stuff, land use, transportation, environmental protection. And then I eventually went back to Florida State and did my PhD in urban and regional planning. And that's when I took a strong turn towards doing work primarily on environmental issues. At the time, I was focused on looking at sustainability and the long-term plan for restoration of the Florida Everglades. And after I finished my PhD, I took a position as an assistant professor in city and regional planning at California Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo. And that's where I am today. I'm a professor there, and I'm also currently the department head. And for about the last, I'd say, decade or so, my interest in sustainability focused more narrowly onto climate change and what we can do from the perspective of the field of city and regional planning to address the issues of climate change.
Oh, okay. So I'm in Key Largo right now. So you're a Florida native then?
I am. Yes. I was born and raised in Florida, and now I live in California. So I've done two of our big coastal states.
East Coast, West Coast. In your book, what was your motivation for writing this book?
It was sort of twofold. One was that I have two co-authors on the book. One is Dr. Adrian Greve. She's also a faculty member in my department, and the other is Tammy Seal, who's a practitioner in the field doing sustainability and climate work, and works for a consulting firm that primarily consults for local governments. And Dr. Greve and I, a number of years ago, sensing that climate change was becoming a more and more important issue, And obviously recognizing that our students, our young folks, were particularly interested in this issue, we decided we wanted to teach a class in climate action planning, which we've now been doing, I think, for almost a decade now in our department. And of course, whenever you're a professor and want to teach a class, the first thing you do is you go try to find a book for your class. And we couldn't find one, or at least we couldn't find one that we thought did everything that we wanted it to do. And after, you know, some consternation over that, we kind of, I think jokingly at first said, well, we should just write our own book. That obviously stopped being a joke, and we actually wrote the book. So our kind of initial motivation was to write ourselves a textbook for our class. But as we worked through and began developing the idea, we realized that, you know, we were just seeing this incredible increase in the number of communities that were starting to do climate action plans, and just not a lot of guidance out there. ICLEI, Local Governments for Sustainability, had put out some guidance, and there are a few other things around, but nothing we thought was sort of fully comprehensive. And so we recognized that professionals out there in the field of sustainability and climate action were looking for a resource that kind of brought everything that we knew about this at the time very emergent field into one place. So that was our second motivation for the book.
So let's start with, what is a framework for community action? We'll just say, like, you're teaching us a class here. What can communities do? What can this book do for, say, the Everglades, the Florida Keys, or California?
Yeah. So, you know, one thing I always try to make clear is it is a book focused at the local level. So we're thinking, you know, cities, counties, communities, maybe even regions, but, you know, it's certainly distinct from state or national or international policymaking on climate action. So we're really trying to focus on communities. And of course, myself and my colleagues as city planners, you know, that's that's what we know best. So what we're trying to provide in the book really is a sort of a A to Z guide on, you know, kind of starting from the point of, you know, somebody in your community thinks that more ought to be done at the community level to address the climate crisis. So what do you do? Where do you even start with this process? And so we start there, and then we describe, we call it a guide, the book, but we describe a process that your community can go through to evaluate your greenhouse gas emissions, to evaluate your exposure, your risk to climate change, and then how you would begin to develop solutions and ultimately implement those solutions. And for many communities, they go through this process and they develop something called a climate action plan, or sometimes they're called like a greenhouse gas reduction plan or an adaptation plan. But other communities are simply trying to develop strategic policy or programs that would inform, you know, whatever part of their community that they're particularly aiming at. So if you were to sort of go through our book and follow the process that we've outlined, at the end of it, you would have developed strategies, policies, programs, actions, however you want to describe them, that your community can implement in order to address climate change. And both on the sense of what is often called mitigation, or reducing, how you reduce your emissions, your greenhouse gas emissions, so that your community is not continuing to contribute to this global problem. But also the other side, what we call the adaptation side, which is recognizing that climate change is going to impact, is already impacting our local communities, and how you can prepare and adapt to those changes.
So how do we do it? Let's say I'm in a community, just because I'm in Miami, how does a citizen get started?
Yeah, so, you know, the book is written primarily aimed at kind of the professional working in city or local governance, and sort of how they would develop this process. But we've tried to also make it a book that is written in a language that would be understandable to members of the general public or to elected officials. And so it sort of depends on, you know, who's reading it as to how you get started. And we talk in the book about this notion of there being a climate champion. You know, in some communities, we saw that they engaged in climate action planning because the mayor got inspired around this issue and came back to their community and said, hey, we're going to, you know, we're going to address climate change. And in other communities, we saw that, you know, citizens or community advocacy groups or community-based organizations came together concerned about this issue and kind of from a grassroots perspective began to develop and implement different kinds of strategies. So, you know, it sort of depends on who the reader is as to where you start. I mean, obviously, if you're, you know, if you're an elected official, you're going to use your, you know, your kind of bully pulpit or your, you know, your profile as an elected official to move your community in that way. If you're a member, if you're, you know, somebody who works in local government, you're the city planner or the public works director, then, you know, working through your internal bureaucracy to move forward on something like this. And if you're, you know, a member that just a member of the public who cares about this in your community, you know, figuring out how to partner with other organizations or like-minded individuals to, you know, raise awareness in the community and hopefully use that to, you know, trigger, you know, substantive action towards the problem.
Well, for our audience, I know that a lot of us have heard about climate change and science and news, but can you give us just a little background on what are we really looking at? You know, what's the science telling us? Is it speeding up, slowing down? Is this going to be an exponential curve on greenhouse gas emissions? Where is it coming from, et cetera? Can you give us a little background?
Sure. Well, you know, globally, emissions continue to rise. And certainly when we look at a number of the impacts of climate change, things like sea level rise, extreme weather events, extreme heat events, ocean acidification, you know, if back in my home state of Florida, we're obviously concerned about hurricanes. As we look at the nature of these hazards and the they call the climate signal within these hazards, we do see and are expecting to see, you know, an exponential increase in many of these. So the problem, the impacts of climate change are here already, and we're starting to experience some of them, and we can expect this to get worse rather quickly. You may recall that about a year ago, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released their report, their 1.5 degree C report, and basically said, you know, we've got 10 years to really turn things around in terms of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions if we want to avoid, you know, the worst effects of climate change. So it really is, you know, we really are already sort of behind in terms of what we need to do. And the evidence is telling us that. And the evidence is also telling us that we have to move very fast and we have to make big changes.
Well, you know, today in the news, we're talking about how we're getting ready to have an Arctic cold blast. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, it's been my understanding that, you know, some people have said that, well, it's cold, that means we don't have climate change. But it's my understanding that even cold is another extreme example of climate change. What can you talk to us about that?
Well, I always caution that I'm not a climatologist. I'm a city planner. okay. But yes, one of the expectations that we have is that we will see more extreme weather events, both you know, heat events and cold events. Weather is not climate. It's, you know, it's always going to be cold in the winter. that's a normal expectation. But when we talk about climate change, we're looking at long-term trends. You know, are we seeing increasing numbers of heat waves beyond the historic norm? And also are we seeing more extreme weather events, whether they be rain events or cold air events, again, over the long term? That can be associated with things that we know are being affected by climate change. So, you know, not to get too technical, and again, I'm not a climatologist, but, you know, we know that As we heat the globe, it is going to affect the way the atmosphere moves and the way the oceans move. And we expect these to result in these sort of wilder weather patterns that in many places we're already experiencing.
Well, that's true. That's what they were talking about, is that weather isn't climate. So,
right.
You're not going to have, you're still going to have snowstorms.
Right, right.
Well, you know, in our communities, what is the biggest greenhouse gas emitter in our local communities?
Well, it can vary tremendously. Back on the East Coast, if your electricity is being generated by burning of coal, then probably for your community, your biggest greenhouse gas generator is going to be the use and or the consumption of electricity. If you are on relatively clean energy, such as we are here in California, for example, then for most California communities, our biggest emission sector is going to be transportation, basically burning, you know, gasoline and an internal combustion engine. So it's going to depend on which community you're in. And in fact, one of the early in our book, we discussed the need as part of the process of acting on climate in your community is the need to inventory your community's greenhouse gas emissions so that you understand for your particular community what are the largest sources of greenhouse gas emissions, such that or so that you can then develop strategies or policies that target those major sectors. So for, you know, a community that's largely getting its electricity from, you know, coal, they may want to really focus on alternative energy strategies, you know, renewable energy development, rooftop solar, better home insulation, you know, better, high efficiency, new construction, those sorts of things. Whereas, you know, community where you're seeing the majority of your emissions come from transportation, then it might be, you know, focusing on, you know, improving biking and walking and transit options in your community, facilitating the transition to electric vehicles by, you know, putting in EV charging stations, those kinds of things to really get at that internal combustion engine challenge.
Well, it was interesting. Yeah, one of the professors that I finished my landscape architecture degree at FIU in Miami, and one of the professors, he did like a carbon neutral house, David Rifkind, and he did a solar rooftop and even a gray water strategy in his house as an example of what can be done. But you know, all these technologies are really nothing new. This is kind of old stuff.
Yeah, we used to give a presentation pretty regularly, go around giving it, and I would say climate action planning is good city planning. And, you know, basically the idea was that many of the things that we've been talking about for 30, 40 years in my field of city planning are the things that we need to do for climate change. There are some novel things we haven't really seen before, or some solutions we haven't really thought about before. But yeah, you know, we've been talking about, you know, the need to, you know, shift people from single occupant vehicles to biking, walking, transit, micromobility. You know, we've been talking about that for a long time. And certainly, the notion of solar orientation of development, high energy efficiency construction, rooftop solar panels. These aren't new ideas at all. And so many of the ideas that we need to address the climate change are ones that we have around. Many of them are well tested. Things like solar, which we've known about for a long time, but the big change there is the cost, right? The cost has come down so significantly, and now we're seeing, you know, cost parity for solar versus fossil fuel combustion. So a lot of the ideas around, there's some not new ideas and some new challenges. I think the big challenge now, or the big difference now, is you know, the urgency. We've always known that, you know, getting people out of their cars was a good idea for a variety of reasons, whether it be congestion relief or local air pollution. But climate change has really indicated that this is now a global emergency. It's not just about certain communities facing challenges.
Okay, well, let's see. I'll do a hypothetical. Let's say, hypothetically, I'm going to be on a county commission here in the Florida Keys, and I want to be an advocate for creating a carbon, low-carbon community. What are some of the policies that I can implement, and what are some of the challenges? Because, I mean, let's get real. You know, the developers generally don't like it, and everybody just cries money, 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 and then nothing happens. What are some things that I can do to convince people that this is good policy for all of us before we go extinct, the humans go extinct?
Well, boy, the Florida, you know, the Florida Keys have a lot of challenges. But let's talk about solution side in terms of greenhouse gas emissions reduction first, and we'll maybe set aside the problem of sea level rise, which is an existential threat to the Florida Keys. But yeah, you know, there's a number of things that can be done in most communities, and many of which now are either relatively low cost or are essentially cost neutral. We're seeing many communities begin to adopt more stringent building codes in terms of ensuring that we're building as high efficiency of a house or a business as we can. And, you know, I remember paying my air conditioner bill in Florida, and it was not cheap in the summer. And, you know, if we can build a really high efficiency house and put in it, you know, the latest technology in terms of high efficiency cooling, or even, you know, there have been some very successful experiments in Florida at building housing that doesn't even need air conditioning, although that's a real challenge, but it can potentially be done. But, you know, these things obviously can lower people's costs. So even if it does create a small cost premium up front, the long-term cost of owning a house could go down. And there's a lot of good, again, I'm not an expert at housing construction, but there's a lot of good studies out there now showing that most of these sort of green strategies around building construction have relatively short payback periods. Encouraging, or we're now beginning to see cities even mandate rooftop solar. Starting next year in California, all new residential construction will be required to have rooftop solar. So that was done at a state level rather than just a local level. So those are some of the energy things, probably two of the bigger ones. And then over on the transportation side, you know, it's really about providing people safe and effective or efficient options outside of simply driving their vehicle. And I think there's sort of two angles to work here. One, obviously, is to provide alternatives to this to the car, right? So increasing the walkability and bikeability of our communities through investments in infrastructure. And also in communities that are large enough to support transit systems to, you know, do everything we can to make sure those transit systems work for people and that that's a viable option for them. And then, you know, but even imagining that, you know, in some communities, a car might continue to be, you know, necessary at times, then, you know, we need to accelerate the switch to electric vehicles. I think we're about to see from the major automakers in the world, we're about to see an explosion of offerings of electric vehicles. So I think we're going to see EV cost coming down here over the next 5 years. You know, one thing that can be done at the community level is to start to provide additional opportunities for EV charging. So workplace or shopping destination electric vehicle charging. And again, that can be done through by local government through incentives or potentially through mandates. Although a lot of employers are beginning to see now the benefits providing EV charging for their employees who are increasingly buying electric vehicles. So a lot of states now have strategic programs to spur investment in electric vehicle charging. And so that's one way to go that in terms of local government being able to help increase the ease for which people can make a choice to buy an electric vehicle. You know, you can charge at home, you know, you can do that. And if you know you can charge at the workplace or at your destination, then you're going to be much more likely to purchase an electric vehicle.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So how am I going to talk people into spending the money, or are communities going to have to raise taxes to do these kind of infrastructure projects? Getting down to the nitty gritty, you know, how much is this going to cost? Unfortunately.
Yeah. That's something you always have to consider is, you know, what are the costs of these programs? And not only what are the costs, but who bears the costs and who gets the benefit? And these things can get complicated at times. You know, we certainly, in the work that I do, we try to pay very careful attention to the equity issues around climate action and ensure that we're not, burdening, particular individuals or groups and particularly those who've already been disadvantaged in some way. Cost can be a real issue, but, in many cases, there's a number of ways. Let me try it this way. There's a number of ways to think about this. So in some cases, investments in something like energy efficiency have very short payback. So you may have noticed that almost every community these days is switching to LED lighting. And why are they doing that? Well, some are doing that because they know it's good for the environment. That's their motivation. But many are doing it because, the payback periods are 2 or 3 years, and then you're saving money. So this is not, LED lighting it might cost you a little more up front, but very quickly you're going to be saving money, and then you're saving money for the long term. So, that's an example of something that is going to save you money in the long term. Things that require an investment, let's take, bicycle lanes or protected bicycle lanes, which do require funding to support. But we know that the vast majority of our transportation dollars are directed into basically building and expanding and maintaining roads. And even shifting a small percentage of our traditional funding that supports, the kind of the single occupant vehicle into walking, biking, and transit can make a big difference. And we've certainly seen places both in the U.S. but also European cities that have had, what I would call quote unquote major investments in bicycle infrastructure. But when you look at the total dollars, it just pales in comparison to how much it costs to, build a parking garage or build a mile of freeway. And yet seeing tremendous payoffs in terms of how much mode share they're able to achieve. So we always have to look at these costs and benefits, but we can't just look at the cost. We have to look at the benefit. What is the potential upside of this, both in dollars, but also in achieving other objectives?
Well, that's true. I've been a temporary local in Paris, and I so enjoyed just being able to use the metro and to walk. And it was just very convenient. And the side benefit to me was I could eat anything I wanted and still lose weight.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a, I'm glad you brought that up, because we often, we also talk about co-benefits in climate action planning, and the notion that, you know, it's kind of, it fits with the good planning idea. A lot of the things that we're talking about doing in climate action planning really have other benefits beyond that they're good for the environment or they help address the global climate crisis. You know, if we can make it, if we can make it where people feel, you know, safe and comfortable walking and biking to work or to the store, and it's efficient for them, not only is that great for the environment, but it's also good for traffic congestion in the community, but it's also good for us. It's good for our public health, right? You can maybe drop your, you know, $50 a month gym membership now and save a little money that way, because you're getting your exercise, you know, biking and walking to the places you want to go.
Yeah, definitely. Because I realized, I was like, you know, I can eat chocolate, I can drink a glass of wine, and I'm like, I just did six flights of stairs. I can get some mousse.
Yeah, we gotta pitch the chocolate angle a little bit more, I think, because that's always a good sell.
Well, can you give me some examples of communities that are doing a good job of making climate action changes?
Sure. And you might recall in our book, we really do in our book try to highlight communities throughout the book, and exemplary communities throughout the book. But we also have a chapter nine in our book, where we identify a number of particular communities who we think, you know, have a story to tell. They have something to teach us. And so, for example, we have, you know, we have some big cities in there. So we have the city of Portland and Multnomah County. And, you know, they're interesting because they've been doing this work for over 25 years now. They really were one of the early leaders in doing climate action work at the local government. And so, you know, they've been doing it so long, they have, they kind of know what works and what doesn't work, and they have a lot of success stories to tell us. And, you know, but we also have smaller communities. We have, for example, the city of Evanston, Illinois. And Evanston's interesting because although most climate action planning efforts are led through a municipal initiative, you know, the mayor, or the city council, or kind of gets this process started as a, you know, as a plan within, you know, developed through a typical municipal action. But Evanston really, their climate planning process really was built by a group of citizens who came together in the late 90s and, you know, decided this was something Evanston needed to deal with. And so they really began planning truly in the community before the city was involved. And then we have, you know, we have places where nobody would be surprised probably are addressing climate action. You know, we have the city of Boulder, Colorado is in there, and they've done some really interesting things in terms of financing. And this is a story kind of still in progress, but basically they have had a partnership with the local utility to help provide funding. We were talking about funding earlier, funding for their climate programs. And of course, you know, Boulder's a kind of a stereotypical community that is very, you know, progressive and forward thinking on environment and those sorts of things. But we also have, you know, cities like Pittsburgh in there, which, you know, kind of in the industrial heartland, right? And Pittsburgh is one of the more, I think, one of the more, in some ways, visionary cities who have taken action on climate change and have really done it through both a grassroots effort, but also building very strong partnerships with the major industries and employers in the city. And, you know, so we try to show that, you know, there's not a one size fits all here approach. Communities vary tremendously in their emissions profile and the expected impacts of climate change, but they also differ, you know, in their economics and their demographic base and their history and their size. And so we try to show that, you know, there's a path for everyone to follow, regardless of the kind of community that you are.
So can you give us some other examples of communities that have been successful at doing this? And how much have they actually, when they've implemented these strategies, do you have any data on how much they've been able to lower their greenhouse emissions? And I don't know, is there any kind of like climate metric that a community could say, this is where we started and this is where we're at right now and this is where we want to go?
Yeah, for greenhouse gas emissions, you know, for reducing our emissions, we describe in the book a process for measuring and tracking those emissions over time, and so there's increasingly data out there. We don't do a lot of the kind of data tracking in our book, but we have some other projects we sort of do some of this with, and there are a number now of national and international reporting platforms where communities can report their emissions on a periodic basis. And so we're beginning to have a lot more data now. And the organization ICLE, Local Governments for Sustainability, which is a national and international nonprofit that's been providing a lot of technical support, also does an annual report and often highlights communities that are showing emissions reductions. But just for example, I mentioned Portland earlier. Portland's emissions in 1990, and this is going to sound a little wonky perhaps to some listeners, but was almost 9 million metric tons of carbon dioxide. And in 2013, they were down to about 7.7. So they have, despite a city that is growing in population and a city that is growing economically, they have been able to reduce emissions. And just as kind of an aside, it's good to point out too that we have increasingly seen this, what we call decoupling, where we are seeing that, you know, in the past, population growth and economic growth was always highly correlated with an increase in emissions. You know, you had more people, they were driving more, you had more industry, they were producing more stuff, all good for the economy. But that meant rising emissions. And we've now begun to see decoupling, where we see communities that are continuing to experience good economic growth and development, the kind, of course, that everybody wants for jobs and economic security, but with emissions reductions. In fact, California as a state, as a whole state, has managed to do this. We have been reducing our emissions over the past decade, and economic development in California and our sort of gross state product has been increasing. So yeah, we've got a few stats like that in our book. Evanston has seen a significant emissions reduction, almost 20% over 12 years. And so we do see that communities are demonstrating success. They're able to measure and report that success, and they're able to do so while maintaining a good economy and arguably improving the quality of life in their community. So it really can be win-win if you develop the right mix of strategies to implement in your community.
Well, I like this. You've got a few. Let's see. This is on page 303, 10 things you can do right now. I love number 10, of course, because I just did landscape architecture. Just plant trees.
Yeah, just plant trees. I mean, I call this an all hands on deck problem. We need individuals taking action. We need cities taking action. We need states. We need our national government, and we need our international institutions, primarily the UN, also leading on. Like, you know, it's not one person or one country or problem to solve. It's everyone's. And so, and there's no silver bullet really either. That's the other thing is, you know, there's not just one thing we can do. And sometimes I'll hear criticisms and people say, well, you know, why should this community do that? Or why should I do this? Or why should we do this thing? You know, it's only a small percentage of emissions. And it's sort of like, well, yeah, but that's sort of everything is that way. So, you know, we're going to have to do a million small things in order to solve this problem. But most of these are things we know how to do, And most of these things are good things to do regardless of climate change. So I'm glad you pointed out plant trees, because, you know, is if we only plant trees, are we going to solve the problem? No. But do planting trees help? Yes. And, you know, who doesn't like to plant a tree or have a tree in their community? You know, people love trees. So, you know, if in your city you planted 10,000 more trees over the next few years, you would be helping address climate change. You would probably also be improving your community in general for everyone.
Well, you know, just kind of a side note, I think it's kind of funny. You know, in Florida, the most valuable parking space anywhere is one with shade under a tree.
Absolutely. Yes.
It's not
just as long as they're a native tree. No foreign trees. We've got enough of those in South Florida as it is.
That's true. It's not the closest parking space. It's the one with shade.
Right. Absolutely. Yes.
And I was thinking about that. I thought, you know, I'm going to talk to these architects because I get a little sidetracked here. But, you know, I've always heard this argument. It always aggravates me a little bit because, like, you know, insurance companies are so against, and people are so against having trees around your house because, well, a storm could bring the tree down. I'm like, you know, these architects are going to have to start building some better buildings because I want to plant some trees. I've always heard that. But my parents, they have tons of trees around their house. And I'll tell you, most people who go there are like, wow, this is so nice. It really increases your property value.
Yeah. I have friends and family still in Florida. And, you know, some of them live in these kind of beautiful hammocked areas where, the trees do potentially present a risk in a hurricane. But, you know, I mean, you certainly can't do things in isolation. You always have to consider the implications. And, you know, it's also the case that every solution is not for everybody, right? So, you know, if you look at things individuals can do, for example, you know, some things might be harder to do than others. If you live in a suburban environment with no transit and a lot of high speed roads, you know, it's certainly difficult for you as an individual to make a decision to say walk or bike more. You're just not in an area that's easy to do. So, you know, maybe that doesn't make as much sense for you, but, you know, one thing that's been very popular is, like, you know, eating less meat. So there's meatless Mondays. Well, everybody can do that. You know, everybody could, you know, cut their meat consumption a little bit and ideally cut it a lot, but at least a little is something, you know, everybody could do without really much of a noticeable change in their lifestyle. So I think, you know, whether it's you as an individual or whether it's your community, you do have to look at what works for you and what works for your community. And that might be different from what works from the next community. And again, we've seen that in our case studies. We've seen some communities, you know, really focus on pursuing, you know, a certain set of strategies that look different from the, you know, even a community maybe kind of next door to them. And it's based on, you know, their own local characteristics. So that's part of what this process is designed to do is to, you know, walk everybody who's involved in the process, the decision makers and the public, you know, through a way of thinking about this problem and developing solutions that make sense for you, as opposed to just saying, well, everybody should do this. You know, we do kind of put the, you know, at the end, here's 10 things everybody should do. And, you know, it's generally a good list, but we stuck it at the end and, you know, for a reason, right? We sort of put it there as, you know, hey, at least, you know, begin to think about doing these ideas, but really you've got to figure out what works in your community.
Well, you mentioned that this is really a textbook that you wrote for your class. How can educators in even high school or colleges use your book in their classrooms?
Yeah. So like I said, it was really written in that sense. I even joke with people, the book has 10 chapters, and that's because at Cal Poly we're on the quarter system and we have 10 weeks in the quarter. So it's even that specific in terms of, you know, how our decision-making went. But I would start with sort of asking the question or I guess folks should ask themselves the question is, what do I want my students to understand about this issue? So just to be clear, our book is not about the science of our climate or climate change. And it's not really even about the impacts of climate change. It's really how at a local level to go about solving the problem. So first you have to kind of understand what you want to teach. So for example, if what you want your students to do is to really understand, you know, why climate change is a problem, how it works, that sort of thing, then I would say, you know, well, I would point you to, and we have this in our book, I would point people to Robert Hinson's book called The Thinking Person's Guide to Climate Change. And it's really an introduction to the science of climate change and some and generally how it'll affect our planet and generally what we can do about it. So if that's your purpose, maybe, you know, that's kind of the thing to read. But if what you want to do is talk to your students about how their community and how they can be involved in their community to at the kind of community scale and through leveraging community resources, your community could become, could both reduce its greenhouse gas emissions profile and also adapt to be more resilient to climate change, then this is maybe the right book for you. And so I would say, take a look at it.
Well, there you go. Well, Mike, thank you so much for being here today. It's been a delight to have you on the show. Can you tell our audience, what are you working on now?
I've got several things going on. We host a California Climate Action Planning Conference every other year. We just finished that this year, so we're already kind of in planning stages for 2021. I've got a couple of studies underway with colleagues, including one very much focused on a kind of a question you asked earlier about implementation. And what we're really trying to do is hone in on what factors are necessary to be very successful in implementation. So, you know, how can you sort of ensure that all these great ideas you have are actually going to make a real difference? So we're doing some research on that. I'm currently assisting a big project with the state of California to update California's Adaptation Planning Guide, which is kind of similar to our book in the sense that it's a guide for local governments on how to adapt to climate change and become more resilient. And then the final one I'll mention is I'm involved with UN Habitat. A few years ago, started a new initiative called Planners for Climate Action. And it's really aimed at professional planners and planning academics and helping us organize together to think about how we can, as a profession, do a better job in addressing climate change and a better job at communicating what skills and tools we can bring forward to help address the climate crisis. So those are a few things. I seem to have 10 other things and never enough time, but those are a few things I'm up to.
I'm sure that's going to keep you busy. Well, you know, I have one last question. What are some things that you do personally to help against climate change yourself?
Yeah, well, I bike or take the bus to work almost every day, probably 95% plus days. And the rare occasion I do drive to work because I have to carry some load of something or another, I have an electric vehicle. I try to eat as low on the food chain as possible. And, I'm a diligent recycler and, you know, those sorts of things. So, but I think the main one for me, the one I feel like really has, you know, kind of defines, my life in certain ways is being a bike commuter, which I really love, to do. I'm lucky to live in a community that has good bike infrastructure and, you know, I have a reasonable bike commute to work every day and reasonable weather most days. But not only is it efficient for me, I can actually get door to door from my house to my office faster because I don't have to hunt for parking on campus, which anybody who's been on a campus knows that parking is often in very short supply. Yeah. So I can actually get to work quicker on my bike than I can in a car. And I get there and I feel good. I feel invigorated. I think it improves my productivity and lets me eat more chocolate.
Well, on that note, thank you, Mike, for being here and for your time this evening. And I hope we hear more from you. let me know about your next book.
All right, sure thing. Great. Thanks for having me on.
Again, thank you so much for listening today. Your book has been Climate Action Planning, A Guide to Creating Low-Carbon Resilient Communities by Michael Boswell, Adrian Greve, and Tammy Seal, published by Island Press in 2019. And again, I'm Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.